Hi, I'm Kate Archer-Kent, in for Larry Mueller today on the Ideas Network. There are a dozen different soil orders that exist around the world, and seven of them are found right here in Wisconsin. We're going to be learning more about what's under our feet with James Bockheim. He's Professor Emeritus in the Department of Soil Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's also co-author of a new book out titled The Soils of Wisconsin. What questions do you have about the soil in your area? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post your questions on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. Jim, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
This is, I understand, the first book on Wisconsin soils in 40 years. Did you need to start from scratch in identifying what's out there in Wisconsin?
Actually, we didn't. The advantage that we have, as opposed to the three previous versions of the book, the first one was in 1927, is that we have the electronic database of the Natural Resources Conservation Service. That it identifies all the soils in the state, it gives their properties. And so we were able to use that. And another advantage that we had over some of the previous versions of the book was the ability to have color photographs. So we have like 180 figures in the book, and 150 of them or so are in color. So lots of photographs of soils.
And that helps in looking at a soil, if you can actually see what you're looking at instead of describing it?
Exactly. Soils are very visual, and they have beautiful colors, and the colors reflect the composition of the soil, how the soil is developed, how well-drained it is, how much iron is in it, a lot of other features.
Take us through the field work, if you will. What was it like out there in the field working on this project?
What we did was we had a series of field trips where we would identify particular kinds of soils that we wanted to describe and have photographs of. But again, a lot of it was just simply accessing the database and compiling it and putting it in a structure of the book.
And how long did this take? This is a very comprehensive book on soil.
The writing didn't take that long, really, because, just from our years of work with the soils. But the photography actually took a lot. And then putting it all together, we published the book with Springer. They were really good in terms of, physically putting the book together.
So what has changed about our soil here in Wisconsin since the last imprint in 1976? What has changed about where we live?
One is we've identified a lot more soils. At the time that Francis Hole published the previous version in 1976, there were only a couple hundred soil series that had been identified. And only the lower half of the state had been mapped in detail, the agricultural area. And then over the last 40 years, the forested areas in the north were mapped, and we now have close to 750 soil series. So the area that's been mapped, the number of soil series that have been identified has changed markedly over time. So we've gotten a lot more information over the last 40 years. In which we can include in the book.
You dedicate your book to this Dr. Francis Hole. Who was he, and what was his contribution to soil research in Wisconsin?
Oh, that's a good question. He was a professor in the Department of Soil Science at the UW-Madison and also in geography, and he also worked for the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey. So he had three offices, and all three were very messy. But he had this ability, if I'd go in one of his offices and ask him, do you have this particular reprint? He'd go down, maybe a foot in the stack, and he'd pull that article out.
Just like soil.
Like soil, yeah. And he was a musician. He played violin, and he led field trips around the state and encouraged the general populace to come on these field trips, not just the professionals, and had a lot of fun singing and looking at soils and telling stories about soils. He developed soil jewelry, and he was just an amazing guy. And when I came in 1975, he was probably 60 years old, and he invited me to go on a field trip with him, and he knew I was a biker. And so we said, let's go out to the Arboretum on our bikes. So we jumped on our bikes, and we went out to the Arboretum, and I could barely keep up with him. And I was in my late 30s, and he's 60 years old. But he was just an amazing person. He was very supportive in my career. And, you know, as I said, he published the third version of the book, and that book has held up for 40-some years.
How were you able to build on his work in soil mapping?
Well, he had identified, he had broken down the state into 10 soil regions. And another thing that I didn't mention earlier, that he had used soil taxonomy, our soil classification system, to a certain extent, but not as extensive as what we do in the current version.
Hmm.
So... So he was just an amazing person, and my co-author, Alfred Hardemink, was working for the International Soil Research Group in Vageningen, Netherlands. And we were at a meeting in Australia, and we were sitting out on the lawn having lunch, and he mentioned to me that he really thought a lot of Francis Hole and the University of Wisconsin. And I said, would you be interested in coming to the university? He said, oh, I would. So when I got back, I mentioned it to our chair, and then he went and talked with the dean, and pretty soon he's on board. And he is a real champion of soils. He's a champion of Francis Hole. He calls his lab the Francis Hole Laboratory.
Nice.
So Francis was just an amazing person, and so we dedicated the book to him.
We're talking with Jim Bockheim right now. He's a professor emeritus in the Department of Soil Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, co-author of the new book, The Soils of Wisconsin. And we'd like to hear your questions about the soil. Perhaps you have a question about soils in your yard at 800-642-1234. You can send an email to ideas@wpr.org, or you can post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Jim, let's take a tour of the soil we have here. Start us off with a soil that is very common in the state of Wisconsin.
Oh, we have several soils that I call mega soils. They're soils that occur regionally over a million acres or so. And the one mega soil that really comes to mind is the Plainfield loamy sand that occurs in the central part of the state. And that is a soil that 60, 70 years ago was mainly jack pine and scrub oak forest. And then farmers discovered that there was groundwater only a few feet below the surface, and those forests were cleared, and that area was brought into irrigation agriculture. And the Plainfield soil doesn't just occur in Wisconsin. It occurs throughout the Midwest. And so that's an example of an extremely common soil. Another soil that's fairly common, but it's not one of the most common soils, is the Antigole silt loam. The Antigole silt loam is our state soil. And much like we have the robin as a state bird and the sugar maple as a state tree, and Francis Hole was instrumental in getting, we were only the second state to have a state soil. And so I can still picture him down at the Capitol with a bunch of school children rallying around the legislators, encouraging them to have the Antigole silt loam as our state soil.
Tell us about this soil and how it was formed.
The Antigole silt loam is classified as an alfasol. Okay, that doesn't mean a whole lot to a lot of people, but an alfasol is a forest soil under broadleaf trees. It's very productive, and it has clay enrichment in the subsoil. And it has a fairly high pH, so it's not a real strongly acid soil. And the alfasols is the most common order in the state. And The anticocele loam occurs in the north-central part of the state primarily, and it's used for forestry. It produces beautiful northern hardwood trees. It's used for pasture, where these forests have been cleared, and it's used for agriculture. So Francis chose that soil as our state soil because of its multiple uses.
Yeah, it sounds like it can multitask.
Yeah.
What is your favorite soil in all? I mean, I don't know if you can pick favorites, but if you could, you know, what would it be and why?
I like the what we call the spodosols. These are the acid forest soils that occur under conifer, under needle-type vegetation in the northern part of the state. They have a very beautiful array of soil layers. We call those soil horizons. A gray layer over dusky, reddish-brown colored soils. And they're just very beautiful soils. And they're not particularly productive, but they will grow pine trees and spruce and fir trees fairly well.
Let's take a call now at 800-642-1234. Gary, hello. What question do you have?
Thank you for taking my call. I've been involved with tallgrass prairie conservation and restoration in Minnesota, Illinois, and Wisconsin for about 40 years, and I've always been intrigued about the soils on these virgin pieces of ground, many of them just a few acres in size, and especially those of us who care about this are always concerned about species diversity in the plants and the amphibians and the insects and the birds on these sites. But there's...
Oh, did we just lose Gary? Are you there?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Continue. We just lost you for a moment.
Okay. And I've always been curious about the...
Oh, now we did lose him completely right before he asked the question.
I don't know what his question would have been, but I can say that the tall grass prairies in Wisconsin, we're at the very northern and eastern part of the prairie province, and the soils that we have under the tall grass prairie are called mollisols. It comes from the Latin word meaning soft, because they have this soft appearance, and they have a very thick, dark-colored surface horizon that reflects the turnover of the prairie plant roots. These are very productive soils, just like the alpha soils that I mentioned earlier. So when the settlers moved across the United States and got to the Midwest, it was only until the mold board plow was developed that they could cultivate these soils because of the dense mat of roots and so on.
Hmm. They were very packed?
They were very, just because of all the roots, you know, it was very difficult to cultivate.
Uh-huh.
So the mold board plow, I mean, they could use horses and so on, but the mold board plow was really instrumental in cultivating these soils, and they're extremely productive soils. And then the alpha soils that I mentioned earlier under the broadleaf trees are also productive soils, but that they required clearing and removal of the stumps and root balls and that sort of thing as well.
What role did the glaciers have in distributing the soil here?
That's a very good question. The glaciers covered nearly all of the state. The only part, about 16% of the state, we call the driftless area, was not covered by glaciers. And so the glaciers, coming from the northeast, brought in new, fresh materials. And so we don't have very strongly developed old soils like, say, they would have in the southeastern part of the state, the red clay region of Georgia and so on. These are not particularly productive soils. Our soils are productive because they've been rejuvenated by glacial activity.
Hmm. Yeah. And what about glaciers has such an impact on soil?
Well, the glaciers originated up in the Arctic and moved across the landscape, scraping up material, mixing it up. So the mixing incorporated different kinds of materials from different kinds of rocks, and so it, in a sense, rejuvenated the materials from which our soils could form.
Nature's rejuvenator.
Right.
A long, long time ago.
Right. Well, not that long ago, really. The last glacier left around 9 or 10,000 years ago. So on a geologic scale, it's not that long ago.
In the grand scheme of things.
Right.
Right. We've been talking with soil scientist Jim Bockheim. He's co-author of a new book out on the soils of Wisconsin. We're learning about all the different soil types we have in our state. What questions do you have about soil in your yard, in your area, in your region? Do you have a question about how you should care for the soil? We want your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. I'm Kate Archer-Kent in for Larry Mueller today. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. And now back to your questions on the soils in Wisconsin with our guest, Jim Bockheim. He's a professor emeritus in the Department of Soil Science at UW-Madison, and he's co-author of a new book titled The Soils of Wisconsin. Call in with your soil concerns and challenges at 800-642-1234. You can also post your questions on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Let's go to a call now, Ray in Stevens Point. Hi, Ray.
Hi, I have a question about soil management and preservation. A couple of weeks ago, we had a major windstorm here in Portage County, and we had sand blowing from the farm field that literally covered some of the roads in the Plover area, and the town actually had to close the roads to traffic because there were big sand dunes on the street, on the road. Preventing cars from being able to pass. That doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense to me in today's world. Can you comment on what's going on there regarding soil management and preservation?
I think what's happened is, if you remember years ago, the fields in that area had tree breaks around them to mitigate against the wind. And a lot of those tree breaks were removed when the central pivot irrigators came in. And so farmers attempt to keep the soil stable by irrigating it. But there are times of the year when the soil gets extremely dry and you can get winds blowing sand over the highway. In fact, as I remember, Highway 51, as you drive north, there are signs that say danger blowing sand in places. So it's a result of our clearing of the soil, exposing the subsoil to the wind, and the removal of the windbreaks and so on that protect the soil.
Should we be concerned about that? Is that going to affect the soil?
Of course, we're losing topsoil, and that is of concern. And the way farmers get around that is that they have to put on fertilizers to replace the nutrients that were contained in the nutrient-rich topsoil. So anything we can do to preserve the topsoil is a benefit.
Ray, thanks so much for your call. Let's now go to Don in Wauwatosa. Hi, Don.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to share a discovery I had about soil. I found the U.S. Geologic Survey maps online of the soil throughout the country, and it was fascinating. But it answered a question for me, too, because I had always been perplexed about why I had different types of weeds in my backyard from my front yard. It turns out that I have two different soil types on my small city lot. One, I think, was the Ozaki loam, and the other one was the Mequon loam. So that answers, for me at least, why the weeds are different in one location than the other.
Yes, that's a good observation. The Ozaki loam is derived from clay, light clay materials, red clay, and it is a quite a productive soil. And farmers are now coming to realize that, in support of what you observed, is that there are different soils located in their fields, and they no longer simply apply the same amount of fertilizer or lime to all their soils, but rather they use what we call precision agriculture. They have a digital version of a soil map. They have a GPS system in their tractor, and when they apply fertilizer, it's applied relative to the kind of soil. So that's helping us a lot in terms of conserving fertilizer and avoiding groundwater contamination. For example, phosphorus that we'll be talking about on the program tomorrow. So your observation is a good one. And
is Don's situation unique? Do we find a number of people who have different soils on their small plot of their property?
Yes, and if you're interested in soils on your property, I would encourage you to use your cell phone if you're a cell phone user. And if you go to the app section on your phone, there's software called Soil Web. And if you press Soil Web, it'll say, get my location, and you can press that, and it will show you exactly what soil you have where you're standing. Now, this assumes that you've got communication. I do a lot of work in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and northern Wisconsin, and quite often, you know, there aren't cell phone towers and so on where I can access. But it'll show you the soil type. For example, the Ozaukee, that one of the listeners mentioned earlier. It'll show you a little diagram of the soil showing the different layers. It gives a classification of it. And then if you want, you can actually continue on this site and you can get lab data and so on. So it's amazing.
I can only imagine how opportune that has been for you as a soil scientist to have that new technology.
It helps, but on the other hand, I remember once I was leading students on a field trip on Black Hawk Island in the Wisconsin River, and I was digging the soil and describing what we were going to see and how the soil would be classified, and one of the students had this particular app, and it was before I had it, and he said, well, that's going to be a such and such, and it's going to look like this, and I turned around and looked at him, and I said, you don't need me anymore.
Well, let's go now. Thank you, Don. Let's go to Tom in Deer Park, Illinois. Hi, Tom.
Hello, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Two things. One, I'd like to buy your book, but I'd like it signed. I don't know if you could do that.
The way to buy the book would be you can go through Amazon.com, or you can buy it from Springer in New York. You know, we're not in the business of mailing out copies. We have a very limited number of copies that are given to us gratis. But if you purchase a copy and you want me to sign it, if you're coming through Madison, there's probably some way we can hook up so I can sign it.
And Tom, you have a question about a tilling question.
Yes, I have some land, and part of it we lease out, and it is currently being leased out to some wonderful farmers that use horses, not tractors, and they do a full till on the corn areas every year versus previous farmers that use tractors that did no-till or very rarely, you know, maybe a slight strip till. And I was wondering your opinion on the short, medium, and long-term future of my soil on that land by virtue of the current techniques that my leasee employs?
Well, it's kind of a difficult question. You didn't mention about, are there crops during the dormant season that are on there? When, you know, to what extent? There are advantages and disadvantages of no-till agriculture. You know, the advantages would include controlling erosion somewhat, but a disadvantage is that the soil takes longer to warm up in the spring, although with the global warming that we're experiencing, that's less of a problem. So it depends on how much the soil is exposed from the horse cultivation, and, you know, whether or not you're using cover crops and so on.
And, Jim, what is the impact of global change on our soils here in Wisconsin?
We have a chapter in the book that addresses that topic, and we have seen over the last 15,000 years or so considerable changes in the distribution of our soils in the state, and we know that from reconstruction of the climate from fossil pollen, from wetlands. And so what we've done in this particular chapter is we have reconstructed the distribution of soils in the state at different periods in time. And then using the modeling that was done by the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change, we predict what the soils might look like another 50 years from now. And so to some of that is due to the warming of the climate, some of those changes, but some of them also have to do with changes that are wrought by intensive irrigation, let's say in the central sands, and other management practices. So it's somewhat difficult to predict what our soils might look like in the future because it depends on the technology that is used in managing the soils as well as changes in climate.
There are many variables.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, Tom, thanks for your call. Let's now go to Keith in Edgar. Hi, Keith.
Hi. I got two questions. One is, what is the effect of earthworms on soil or not earthworms? As I understand it, the glaciers have something to do with where earthworms are and where they're not. And the second question is, how much of our soil comes from out west? And how far out west? In other words, how much is blown in, and how far does it reach into Wisconsin?
Oh, those are very interesting questions. When the glaciers came through the Great Lakes region, they destroyed the native earthworm population. And the giant earthworm that we have, the Lumbricus terrestris that we have today, is actually an exotic. It's a non-native. And we have seen in parts of the state where these earthworms have actually changed the forest floor in our forest ecosystems, especially around the lakes where fisher persons have fished and then they throw their earthworms away when they're done. And so around the margins of our northern lakes, we do see areas where the organic material from the duff, from the litter of the forest, has been mixed in the soil by the earthworms. So it's not a native species. Earthworms have the advantage of processing the soil material, and as they do, they enrich it. So, you know, in a certain sense, there's some advantage to having that, but it does change our native, the exotic Lumbricus species has changed our native earthworm population and the soils as well. As far as soils from the west, there is such a thing as long distance transport of dust, but generally it's a small enough quantity that it's something we can't really detect in our soils. So we don't see a lot of long-distance transport of dust in our soils here. But certainly it's a process that occurs on the Earth's surface.
Well, Keith, thank you so much for your questions. We're talking right now with Jim Bockheim. He's the co-author of the new book, The Soils of Wisconsin. He's a professor emeritus in the Department of Soil Science here at UW-Madison. And you can join in this discussion about the soils of Wisconsin at 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Judy emailed to say, I live on Madison's east side, and almost my entire yard is rock, the size of river rock, she writes. There are not many spots that I can sink a shovel for planting. How could this rock have been deposited here?
Well, I would, the possibility is that it's, the likely possibility that it's glacial deposits, or it could be river deposited material. But I would encourage you to get that app and go out and explore on your own and see what particular series there is there. Now, you don't have to. You can also get the soil survey of Dane County. And in the back of the hard copy of the survey, which you can get from your library, are a series of maps. And if you can find your location on that map, it'll identify what particular soil series you have. And then you can go forward in the book, and it will give a description of that soil series and how it's classified and that sort of thing. So you can do it electronically or just using a hard copy of the Dane County Soil Survey. Or the other option would be is you could get the Quaternary Geology Map of Dane County, which was produced through the UW Geology Department some years ago, and you could identify your location on that and see what kind of material you have on the site.
And Jim, once we've identified our soil where we're standing, how should we care for that soil? How does that inform us how we work with that soil and care for it?
This was a theme, caring for the soil, that Francis Hall really really made a strong point of. In fact, I remember him in my office. I could look out on Observatory Hill, and he'd be out there with a bunch of children, preschool children, and he had an auger, and he'd take a little sample of the soil, and he'd give it to the children, and then he'd take his violin out, and he would play just a wonderful tune and say, "This is what the soil is like when humankind is in harmony with the soil." But then he would take and he'd squawk the violin and say, "When we don't treat the soil properly, this is what happens." So when you think of it, we're so dependent on the soil. 95% of our food products come directly from the soil. Our forests, you know, as far as the lumber and timber and so on that we use to build our houses. Aluminum and iron ore comes from weathered soil material. We bury our people in the soil. We're created from the dust of the earth. So the soil really is an important component of our system, and we rely on it very strongly. And so it behooves us to try and protect that soil as much as possible. We have a chapter in the book that identifies rare, endangered, and endemic soils in Wisconsin. Endemic soils are soils that only occur in one particular region. And about 14% of the soil series in Wisconsin are endemic. They only occur in Wisconsin. They don't occur anywhere else. And we have a number of soils that, because of their limited acreages, are considered to be endangered. And so I think it's really important that we care for our soils, for future productivity, for agriculture, for all the other uses that I mentioned as well.
And Jason emailed us to ask, how long does it take for an inch of new soil to form?
That is a really good question. An inch of soil in the Arboretum, the UW-Madison Arboretum, would take about 200 years to form. There were fairly strongly developed soils that had formed under the Washington Monument. 200 years. They had fill material when they put the monument in 200 years ago. They had fill material, and 200 years thereafter, a soil had actually formed. So soils form fairly rapidly, but, within the human lifetime, not that rapidly.
Well, thank you so much for these emails coming in. Let's now go to Kent in Milwaukee. Hi, Kent.
Hi. I was wondering what could be done to facilitate the ability of soil to capture carbon.
Well, as you know, soils contain abundant carbon, but the carbon comes primarily from the vegetation. And so the way in which we can control soil carbon is through the control of the vegetation. So by keeping perennial vegetation on the site, where the leaves are dropping and decomposing and releasing broken down carbon compounds, and earthworms and other organisms are mixing that carbon into the soil, the roots are dying back periodically in the soil, releasing carbon. So to keep the soil vegetated is the way to enable the soil to trap carbon.
And in your foreword to this book, you have UW Chancellor write it. Tell us about the tie that Chancellor Blank has to the soil here.
Chancellor Blank, her father was a soil scientist. He got his PhD at the University of Missouri in Columbia back in the early 1940s. And she used to go around I think they lived in the Dakotas for a while, but she would go with him on his field trips. And I don't know, Alfred somehow found out about, Alfred, my co-author, found out about this and asked her to write the foreword. And she has just been wonderful. We had a book launch and she came and she spoke. And so it's just, it's heart-rending to see how, and my, you know, I took my children on field trips and Francis Hole did the same. His son and his daughter came to the book launch, and we had a wonderful visit with them. And so this father-son, father-daughter, mother-daughter, mother-son relationship is really a wonderful thing.
Soil science in the blood.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We have time for one more quick call, thanks to Kent in Milwaukee. Let's now go to Nancy in Verona. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. And I have a question. Could you say a little bit more about the soil that's endemic to the Driftless area, which contains a lot of LOESS, I think it's loess?
Yes. LOESS is loess in German. It's L-O-umlaut S-S, or loess. Loess, some people say it's not really the correct pronunciation. But what happened was when the glacier was in the process of advancing or retreating, you had these broad braided streams coming off the ice, and the wind was coming down. The ice sheet creates its own climate, and the wind is coming down. It's picking up, winnowing out the silt and blowing it around on the landscape. And so in Wisconsin, the loess, or the windblown silt, is thickest in the southwestern part of the state. And so that material also occurs in the Driftless area. Now, it's not a glacial deposit. It's a aeolian or windblown material. So the Driftless area doesn't have drift. It doesn't have glacially deposited material, but it certainly has material that's been weathered for long periods of time, oftentimes covered with loess. And you living in Verona live in a very interesting area because that's where the end moraine, the Johnstown end moraine, comes through. And so you're right on the edge of the Driftless area. So depending on where you live in Verona, you're either living on the moraine with till, or if you're living slightly further to the west, you're in the outwash area, whereas the glacier is sitting there and it's pouring off material off the front. Or if you live far enough from Verona, you could be in the Driftless area itself that has not been covered with outwash or with glacial material.
Well, Nancy, thank you so much for your call. So much to talk about in the soils of Wisconsin. It's been such a pleasure. Jim, thank you so much for coming on the show.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
Jim Bockheim is the co-author of the new book, The Soils of Wisconsin. He is Professor Emeritus in the Department of Soil Science here at UW-Madison. Coming up after the break, we'll talk with two scientists about what the buildup of phosphorus is in our soil and what it's doing to watersheds. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, sitting in for Larry Mueller. We'll be back after a short break here on the Ideas Network.